Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 2 of One on One. On this edition, we enter the crazy world of Formula 1 ahead of the second race of the season at Imola. My guest is none other than Formula 1 presenter Will Buxton. We chat about his journey from Autosport magazine intern to the face of one of the most recognizable sports brands in the world. We dive into his love of motorsport, his time at GP2, and we even sneak in a little bit of a chat from the race of Bahrain and the remaining 22 races of the Formula 1 season. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did producing it. Will, thank you so much for joining One on One. It's an absolute privilege to have you on the podcast for episode 2. How are you today, mate? It's exciting.
I'm very good, man. I'm very good. Thank you for having me on. Very much appreciated. I'm good. Britain is slowly coming out of lockdown. So today is the day we're allowed to go to the pub for a pint, so long as we sit outside. And it snowed. So, I mean, you know, it's all coming good.
I would almost say it's so very British that finally
isn't it?
There's an opportunity and... It snows. I mean,
yeah,
you couldn't pick it.
But guaranteed, we will all be sitting outside in scarves, woolly hats and big jackets, shivering with our pint of beer, which will still somehow be warm. So
It's true. It is very weird. But of course, we're here to talk about your career, which has spanned over 20 years of pure brilliance, entertainment and excitement. And of course, we're going to add some other things along the way. So I guess the first question I could ask you is, what inspired you to love Formula One?
Oh, boy. It's a subconscious thing. You know, I didn't choose it. Oh, it's going to sound cheesy, but it didn't choose it. It chose me. I think that's how it is for all of us with the sports that we love. You can't fall in love with something because someone tells you to. You know, the biggest fan in the world of the greatest sport in the world could sit you in front of it and say, this is amazing, and it could leave you completely flat. One of my earliest childhood memories was going to the Prescott Hill Climb, which was near where I grew up. And that was my first experience of motorsport of any kind. And I think it was just the noise and the smell and, you know, the color and the sort of really just how vibrant racing was that got me excited about it. And I guess because it's quite scary as well, particularly when you're that young, kind of 3 or 4 years old, and everything around you are these seemingly huge machines that are really scary and make these sort of horrible shrieking noises. Yeah, I think fear was probably my first impression of motor racing. And then I fell over this massive tent peg on a big kind of awning that was out there and gouged a massive chunk out of my leg. And so I spent the rest of the day crying. And I still have that scar on my shin. So motor racing, I always say, kind of physically affected me from the first day. But then, you know, just sort of being at home and catching Grand Prix on a Sunday afternoon, which were always on the BBC with Murray Walker. And how could you not get excited with that voice and the visceral nature of Formula One with the sound and those shrieking engines with the, you know, those red and white McLarens flying through the trees at Hockenheim or Monza or wherever it was, you know? And that's the era that really pulled me in, that mid to late 1980s Senna, Prost, Mansell, you know, into the early 90s. That was my era. That's when I kind of got hooked on it and just completely fell in love, and then pulled my dad in as a result. Like, he, you know, he'd grown up in sort of he was born in the 40s, so he was teenager through the 1960s, and you know, he knew Jim Clark and Graham Hill and all of that. He wasn't a massive motor racing fan, so it was my passion for motor racing that really got my dad into it, and it just became a family tradition that every Sunday after Sunday lunch we'd all gather around the TV and watch the Grand Prix.
That's amazing. That's awesome. Is there a particular driver in that group that really captured the imagination of 8-year-old Will and really just made you think, damn, these guys are amazing?
Oh yeah, Senna. You know, beyond any doubt, it was Senna. And I don't know if it was because that yellow helmet was so distinctive, and so it was the thing that kind of lodged itself in your memory the easiest. But I always remembered the impression or the excitement of speed, and the excitement of racing always sort of made my heart beat that bit faster when it was him on the screen. And it was Senna. It was always Senna. I was never one of those very kind of patriotic racing fans who just supported a British driver or a British team. I was a Senna fan. That was it. He was, my bedroom wall was covered in posters of Ayrton Senna. You know, we'd go to Arprice, which was like a little music shop in the UK, a big chain actually, it doesn't exist anymore. And they had all the posters in there, and Woolworths, and they had their poster section. You can't buy posters in the UK anymore. It's mad. I've got an 11-year-old daughter, and I went out, and you know, where do we buy posters from? You can't buy posters anymore. It's insane. I used to love going to HMV or Arprice or Woolworths and flicking through the posters. And, you know, you'd have all of the music posters and then all the pretty girl posters. You know, the girl in the tennis skirt with the, you know, and it's, you'd never get away with it now. But that was, you know, big poster. That was very, very famous. The Athena poster shops. But yeah, and I would always flick straight through. Past the Ferrari Testarossa and the, you know, and all of the Lamborghini Countach and all of those kind of posters, and then there'd be one or two Formula One posters, and it was then the Senna. So my bedroom was just filled with Ayrton Senna posters.
That's awesome. I mean, when I was growing up, and it was really the early 2000s, it was dominated by Ferrari and Michael Schumacher, and I went the other way in that I was a big Ralf Schumacher fan because it was too vogue to be a Michael fan. So Ralf was my go-to guy, and you just be like, okay, he's going to get one this is the weekend he's going to get a race win. And you'd be like, 2003 rolls around, they've got the best car on the grid, and you're like, this is the year. And then they invested in solely on Montoya to win, and he was the better driver to win. And then, of course, Ross Brawn went. We know. I think we know what happened there. And Ferrari wins the last three races of 2003, and Michael Schumacher wins the title. It's not by accident.
It's amazing when you talk about Ralf, because he's much maligned in history. But honestly, to win any races in that era, when you look at the quality of the field and you look at who was dominating and overall how, you know, they're now perceived in the sport, there were days when Ralf took it to Michael and won on merit. And you think, you know, he was way more than just Michael's sort of slightly podgier younger brother. He was a quality racer in his own right.
100%. His first race win at Imola, he won by half a minute. And it was just, he, on his day, when the car was set up, he could be at the level required.
Yes. On his, but this is the thing, and you know, I talk about, you know, loving Ayrton. I was also a massive Damon Hill fan, obviously, because I never warmed to Mansell, never warmed to Nigel, but Damon just seemed just a lovely guy and wholesome. And I loved also, because I was a Senna fan, when Senna died, my allegiance naturally kind of shifted to Damon as he took the team. And it's mad, because over these years of doing what I do, I now know Damon, and, you know, and it's kind of weird that this guy who I used to absolutely worship is now someone that I can just have a conversation with and just talk to. And he is just as wonderful and as lovely as I'd hoped he would be. And he, you know, we had this chat one time, and he was sort of explaining how, if there's any point at which he gets down, he just about his career or whatever, he just remembers that on his day at his best, he beat Michael.
Yeah.
And Michael's the greatest of all time, potentially. But Damon said, you know, on my day, when I was absolutely at my best, he said, and he's very humble about it, and it didn't happen often, but on my day, when I was at my best, I beat Michael Schumacher. In a fair fight, I beat Michael, and I'm so proud of that. And you're like, yeah, that's...
You should be.
That's mega. Yeah.
It's crazy to think he probably should have won 94 as well, except for the...
Undoubtedly. 94 was his.
Right here. Right, literally, probably 10K away from where I live.
And imagine that, just that one moment, if he just, but you go for the gap, you go for, yeah. And he saw the gap, but Michael's car was mortally wounded. Michael would never have finished the race. And if Damon hadn't made his move then, I mean, we'd be looking at a completely different, a completely different history. But anyway, we digress.
Alas, we should talk about your motorsport career. And, you know, you didn't study journalism. We were talking about this off air. You studied politics. What was the reasoning behind politics? And we should talk about your thesis, which was on Formula One politics. So maybe talk about the start at university, and then we'll talk about the best thesis of all.
Well, so it rolls back to my love of Ayrton. And when he died, my dad brought me my first copy of Autosport magazine. And I knew then immediately what I wanted to do with my life, which was to write about Formula One. That was it. From the age 13, that was what I had my mind set on. And my cousin was a leader writer at the Times in London, and sort of said, look, you know, you can go to university and you can study media studies or journalism, but at the time, those degrees weren't great.
Yep.
They weren't brilliant. And my parents wanted me to get a degree because they backed me all the way for, you know, for this crazy mad dream I had. But they said, please just get a degree in something serious so that if it doesn't come off, you've got something you can fall back on. And I always loved history. I loved English. You know, I loved the writing aspect, and I always loved history. And I could have gone to uni and done history, but my cousin said, why don't you do politics? It'll teach you everything you need for journalism. It'll teach you to research. It'll teach you to, you know, form your own conclusions and write cohesively and coherently. And you know, I was an argumentative little bastard as a kid, still am. And politics seemed like a really good idea. I got to, you know, go to university and shout at people. It was brilliant. So so I did that. And then it got to, final year. Will, you've got to write 12,000 words, which at the time seemed terrifying. 12,000 words was like, now it doesn't seem so bad. My thesis, everyone was doing it on something serious. And I thought, I can't possibly do European fiscal policy or, I'm going to do something fun. So I just did the politics of Formula One. And I basically tried to argue that we could learn something about democracy and democratic process by studying Formula One, because it operated as a nation state without territorial boundaries. So it had a president, you know, it has the FIA, so the sort of the structure of the FIA and how that worked with Max Mosley at the time as president, how he's elected, and ultimately then the rules that they make, which create the laws that govern the sport, and where Bernie fit into that, and the teams and the drivers, and how they're all kind of a party to a constitution, but they don't get to directly elect their leader. So it was this real sort of, it was democratic, but perversely democratic. So I tried to sort of argue this, look at this, this is this crazy form of weird, perverse democracy that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. And they tried to fail me on it. It was terrible. It was so bad. It was, I read it through, I found it a couple of months ago, and it was, oh man, there's no wonder they tried to fail me on it. It was pathetic. But it got me out of writing about something kind of serious. And in the researching of it, I had met at the Autosport show David Tremaine, a brilliant journalist, who had put me in touch with Joe Sayward, brilliant journalist. And Joe's specialty was the politics of Formula One. Joe had sent me reams and reams of information about the history of politics in the sport. And they both really helped me to get this thesis done. And so I sent it to them. Joe was putting my articles on his website from my final year at university. And then I graduated uni, and 3-4 months after graduating uni, I'm working in a bar as a waiter, and I get a phone call, and it's David Tremaine, and he says, we need some help writing the Formula One annual for F1 magazine for Bernie. Do you want to come and help us write it? And I did. I worked 2 weeks at F1 Mag doing the annual. And I never left until it closed down. That was it. I was there for the next 2.5 years.
That's amazing. After that, you got an accreditation. I think it's the Daily Mail, if I'm not correct. Yep.
Metro.
Metro. That's the
which
one.
It was like a free newspaper that you get on the underground in London and on the buses and all of that. It was really cool. It still is, actually. It's really good form of free, and the pass on readership is absolutely huge. Formula One magazine had been closed down with a week to go until the start of the 2004 season. So I managed to get an accreditation through the FIA for Metro newspaper. My parents lent me a little bit of money to buy a camper van, and I drove to all the European races in 2004 and stayed in the campsites. And it was great. It was really, really fun.
Do you find it interesting looking back at it now that, you know, for how different it was? You're almost humbled by it took so much effort and time to get to those European races, and then to look at now where you, I assume, fly to every single race, and, you know, Formula One looks after you and stuff like that. Do you almost find it weird that, you know, you were a journo, but you were also with the fans at the same time?
I was very much still a fan, you know, because I was learning my craft. But at the same time, particularly that year in 2004, I had pretty much just assumed that it was all over, and that I wasn't ever going to work in Formula One again after 2004. I just assumed it was over. So I would write for Metro newspaper. I would go to all the races, and I would just enjoy myself. I was never one really for serious networking or, you know, trying to leverage a position, or I've never been very good at that. You know, I've never been one to sort of pick up a relationship with somebody or talk to somebody because I wanted something from them. I've always hoped to be a bit more genuine than that. And so I just went along and enjoyed it. And drove to all the races and wrote about my experiences and just assumed that it would all be over. So I had a hell of a lot of fun. And driving from race to race, you know, it was old school. It's how people had done it, and the people that I looked up to, it's how they'd started. They had driven from race to race, you know, in their younger years. They'd slept on the back seat of their car, you know, under a rug or whatever in the 70s and the 80s. And I was just kind of doing the same thing. But I had the benefit of a little Volkswagen camper van, and it was mega. It was absolutely mega. You know, Imola was my first race, and then I drove from Imola to Barcelona, Barcelona up to Monaco. It was mega. And at the end of that year, well, I'm thinking I've got no career left. This is it. I've spent every penny that I have. I'm completely broke. I get the offer of, would you like to become a press officer at GP2, and GP2 was what's now known as Formula 2. And back in those days, there wasn't a really clear route through to Formula 1 for a lot of drivers. You could go to Formula 3000, you could do Formula Nippon, you could do all these different championships around the world, and they wanted to really streamline it and rebuild Formula 3000 into Formula 2, but at the time it was GP2. Some argument over who owned the name. And so GP2 was born, and I became their press officer, and I moved to Switzerland. And then that kind of chapter of my career began. And it was, yeah, from really just expecting it all to be over, suddenly there was this lifeline of something really absolutely wonderful and completely unexpected.
And it's quite crazy when you look at it now, how GP2 was in the early 2000s. You had Hamilton, Rosberg, you know, Nelson Piquet Jr., Timo Glock, Vitaly Petrov, Lucas Degrassi, and an endless plethora of names. You look at that 06 season, for example, and I think most people will remember Turkey, where Hamilton spun at turn one and had the drive of his life. As the press officer, how difficult was it kind of to deal with, say, the media, who were probably wanting to get all over Lewis after that performance, and just, yeah.
Well, the interesting thing, the really fascinating thing was we were our own little bubble. We were our own little paddock, and it still is. And it's got a really wonderful vibe down there, Formula 2 and Formula 3, same as GP2 and GP3 had, a very kind of family atmosphere, much more like IndyCar than like Formula 1, a real sort of sense of community, a spirit of togetherness. Because for a lot of drivers, it was as high up the ladder as they knew they were ever going to get. For some, it was their last chance to have fun before making it to Formula One. But for everybody, it was just an opportunity to put themselves on that stage and show everyone what they could do. And the same for mechanics, engineers, the same for press officers, for journalists. GP2 was their route through. It's where they learned their craft, sort of a finishing school, if you like. And we were all really aware of that. But Lewis, I tried to organize media time with Lewis at all of the early races. And a couple of times, no one turned up. It was like there was no real, oh, yeah, okay, he's another kid coming through. Lewis was a bit different in that, there'd been knowledge of Lewis for forever in the UK. But still, to have to walk that extra 200 meters to come from the Formula One paddock to the GP2 paddock was a bit of a ball ache for some of the journalists. So but then when it became very clear that Lewis was destined for Formula One, McLaren took all responsibility for his media time, and I wasn't allowed to organize anything without their advance say so. So in a way, it became easier because they handled it all, but then it also, when you're trying to PR a championship and one of your drivers, you've now got this extra layer of bureaucracy to go through. It's a bit difficult, but we made it work, and it was wonderful. A championship that went all the way down to the wire to the final weekend, and Lewis won the championship from Nelson Piquet Jr. It was a great year. It was a great year and a brilliant championship.
I wonder what happened to that Lewis Hamilton fella. I've heard good things about him.
Yeah, I think he did all right, I think. Don't know, you never hear much about him.
No, not at all. From there, you went to Speed, which was owned by Fox, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, so I did 3 years as a press officer and I loved it, but I always felt it was a bitter pill to swallow when I had to write a press release that I knew had, was kind of shaping the truth in a certain way. I was a journalist first and foremost, and PR and journalism are, two sides of the same fence. But I wanted to fall down on the other side of the fence, which was getting to the bottom of the shaping of the truth that the press officers had to give out. So I wanted to go back and do that. So actually, I became editor of a new virtual magazine called GP Week, which was actually run through Aussie Motorsport News. So based out in Melbourne, through Chris Lambden. It was really great fun. And at the end of that first year, I picked up a microphone for the first time and started commentating on GP2 because they, for some reason, didn't have a commentator one weekend and needed someone to do it. So I gave it a go, and I absolutely loved it. And then did that for a whole year the next year whilst writing for GP Week. And at the end of that year, I got a call from the States, which was from Speed, and they said, "We've heard your GP2 commentary, and we totally love it. And would you like to be our pit lane reporter?" And so, yeah, there we are, from journalism to television in the space of a couple, yeah, literally a couple of years. It had gone, no career left anymore in 2003, camper van 2004, press officer 05, 06, 07, back to writing 8, 9, and then 2010, I'm pit lane reporter to the United States of America, talking about Formula One. Like, completely insane. Completely insane. So 5 years on from really, it was all pretty much over. Just mad, really. And I guess kind of evidence that when the opportunities come, you just gotta grab them, just go and go for it, and you never know what'll open up as a result.
And
But
it's
it was never, as I was never, I was never searching for it. I was never, getting into these things with a view of where it would take me or what I could get. I was just enjoying the moment as it came, and by enjoying it and giving it everything I had, these opportunities just kind of, they came as a result.
hey, sometimes you've got to be in the right place at the right time, but there's also the case of if you're good enough to do something, those opportunities will come your way. And I kind of wish I have had a YouTube channel for this, because when I see you speak, there is a clear excitement in what you're talking about, the journey that you've been on, and I love that. That's absolutely amazing for me, because when you get to speak to people who have done it for so long, and every single day they love it, they eat it up, it makes everything so much more. Because when you watch people do their craft, and you look for the mannerisms, and the mannerisms, certain mannerisms are, you know, some people were a little bit stiff, or they, you know, that some people were very vibrant and they show a lot of flamboyancy. And the clearest thing that I've found, even in the short period of time we've been talking, is that it's not really, everything you've done is not really a job. It's more of a, I'm here and I love every moment of it.
That's the incredible thing. They always say, if you do a job that you love, you never work a day of your life. That's not completely true, because you do work, yeah, and you know, and it's hard, but it's a continual joy. And I've always said the day that I don't enjoy it anymore is the day that I'll go and do something else, because, you know, it's such an honor, and it is such a rare thing to be able to do this, that if I wasn't enjoying it, well, I don't think I'd have any right to continue to do it. And I would rather, you know, hand that torch over to somebody who would carry that joy and that passion through. But, you know, 20 years in, still loving it. How can you not? You know, every day that I walk through those gates, I'm back to being 13 again, and filled with that same joy and that same exuberance and excitement of, wow, I'm doing my dream job. This is the coolest thing in the world.
Do you have to sometimes pinch yourself when you see Lewis in the paddock or Daniel Ricciardo and be like, I can't fanboy it. I need to really be professional.
No, not so much. Not so much. Because they're just like, look, I absolutely think what they do is the greatest thing in the world. You know, and I am obviously, you know, in awe of their talent and their skill and their abilities. But it's, for me, it's more, it's like I could walk down the paddock and Alain Prost will say hello, or Damon Hill will say hello, or Carlos Sainz Sr. And then I'm just like, ah, you know, that for me is like, oh my God, that's crazy. Because they're the people that I read about. They're the ones that I, you know, as a kid that I looked at, who made me want to do this. That makes me go, oh my God. Or the weird moments if you meet, you know, like a celebrity who's at the race or something. And they're like, oh, I watch you on TV. And I'm like, oh my God, I watch you on TV. You know, and it's like, it's weird. Oh, it's crazy. We were walking through, my producer and I, my former producer and I, we were walking through the pit lane one time and in Monza. And we're walking along, and this lady's walking next to us, and she turns around and she goes, oh, you know, Will, hi, you know, I'm here from the States, blah, 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 blah. And I just want to say, we totally love what you do, and it's brilliant. I'm like, oh, thanks so much. And she goes, my husband's a huge fan. I'd really love to introduce you. I was like, oh, great, cool. So we're walking up, and she's like, Will, this is George. It's George Lucas. And I'm like, this is mental. And George is just like, hi, Will, you know, we watch you every week, really love it. And I'm just like, oh, I'm just completely lost it. Yeah, mad, man. It's mad.
Your impact in the States is well and truly clear. You also spent some time at NBCSN when Formula One was part of there. And one thing we'll talk about is a series you did with the Ferrari Junior Academy called the Florida Winter Series. Now, if you don't know what this is, the videos are still up on YouTube, which I had a quick look just to see what was going on. Tell me about that experience, because you go from being Will, sort of the journalist, the professional, sees these guys as heroes, to I'm actually given an opportunity to race against some pretty decent caliber drivers. And we're talking off air, in that series, you had Max Verstappen, Lance Stroll, Nicholas Latifi. There was also Tatiana Calderon. How amazing was that opportunity, and how did it come about?
So NBC Sports was an amazing opportunity. Formula One moved from Speed over to NBC. And no one had ever put the investment or the money into Formula One in the States quite as NBC had. And the figures were jumping up. They were really starting to rise. And Formula One's interest level in the States was growing as a result. You know, they were putting commercials in the middle of the Super Bowl for the Australian Grand Prix. that kind of investment had never been put into the sport before. So it was absolutely huge. And as a result, the viability and the commercial viability of doing things on NBC suddenly became pretty big for a lot of the teams. And Ferrari at the time had a brilliant head of PR and marketing. It's a guy called Renato Bisignani. And he just kind of grabbed me in the paddock one day and he's just like, "Will, like, do you race?" And I'm like, "Nah, I did a bit of karting with my mates." He's like, "Do you want to do some racing?" I was like, "Sure, what you got in mind?" Thinking like, "Wow, this might be cool. I might get to do like the Ferrari challenge or something, you know, in a Stradale or something. I don't know." And he's just like, "Cool, right, okay, I've got an idea." And then he emails me and says, "Right, so this is the concept. You're going to go to Florida. You're going to go and race single-seaters with the best up-and-coming youngsters. And it's going to happen in February, or was it January, in 2014. And it just kind of blew me away. And so I had basically 6 weeks to get my fat ass in shape and go to Florida and race these kids, like really quick kids, some of them straight out of go-karts, some of them already racing Formula 3. And it was a preparatory series for them, so sort of Formula 4 level cars, all spec, and just jump in and go. And it was a massive learning curve for me, you know, from absolute rookie, 17 seconds off the pace in my first session, to right at the end of the three races as well over the weekend. And I was lapping in my final race. I think my best lap was 2.5 seconds off the top. I'll take it. You know, I'll take that. And I loved it. Just the experience of, you know, what downforce actually feels like when you finally have the commitment and the confidence to stick it in the corner as fast as it's supposed to go. And it holds to the road. And you're like, "Oh, God, this is what it feels like." Because I've been talking about it, writing about it, commentating on it for years because I understood the theory. But then when you feel it in practice, it's something so different. And finally, an understanding of what tires actually feel like when they start to go over the edge, when they start to lose grip, what it feels like when you run offline and you pick up all of the crap on your tires, and how long it takes to get them back to normal. If you flat spot a tire, the vibration and how, honestly, going down a straight, you can't see because everything is shaking so much. It started to rain, so what a wet track feels like on slick tires, all these kind of things. It was an amazing experience. And as you say, going up against Max Verstappen and Nicholas Latifi and Lance Stroll and all these brilliant drivers who've gone on to do so much, it was a real... it was an honor, really. It was. I can't say I raced them, but I shared a racing track with them.
That's more than many of us normies can actually say. I know it was a time ago, but could you tell that someone like Max was going to be as prominent?
Instantly.
Yep.
Instantly, because every single driver there despised him already. And the more experienced kids who were already in Formula 3, you know, their feathers were ruffled by his arrival, because he was doing things with the car that they couldn't even then. And he was straight out of karts. I mean, he was young. He was like, what, 14, 15? And he was properly young, but he was just so, it was so natural to him. And he was just so gifted. And the amazing thing as well is it was an open championship. So all of the data was available to all of the drivers, so everyone could see what everyone else was doing and learn from them. And Max's data trace was, for a lot of the drivers, was just completely unobtainable. They just didn't know how he was carrying the speed that he was, how he was getting on the power as early as he was. It was absolutely incredible. And then that's, you know, it's the kind of stuff you can't teach. It just is for some people.
And it's clear now where he, and we'll talk about the season in a moment, he's got a real chance of winning his first championship this season.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he really does.
So we'll get to that in a moment. But as you've been in the industry for a good portion of time, and hopefully for...
It's okay. You can say I'm old. It's
no,
all right.
Never, I'm... never. I won't do it. I refuse. I refuse to do it. I, you know, you've had generations of new cars and regulations and drivers coming and going. What's the biggest noticeable difference from when you started to now?
In terms of the technical regulation, or just in general?
In general, as what have you noticed from when you first started, first day in the paddock to first day in the paddock 2021 in Bahrain?
Huge. I mean, obviously, I'm going to take COVID out of it, because that is a sort of a false reality of where things naturally are. The biggest difference of all has come as a result of the move from the Bernie Eccleston era of Formula One into the Liberty Media era of Formula One. Bernie created this amazing global sport, which, you know, he took it from a ragtag operation where people never knew who was actually going to turn up to the races, to, you know, the single most watched sport, regular sporting event in the world. Only the Olympics and the World Cup have more viewers, and they happen every 4 years. This thing happens every 2 weeks. You know, that was Bernie's genius, was creating this global phenomenon. But time moved on. The world, how we get our information, how we enjoy sport has changed. And in a very rapidly evolving digital world, Bernie wasn't evolving at quite the same speed. So with Liberty Media's takeover, that has changed substantially. And the sport as a result has changed tremendously. There's more communication, there's more cooperation between the teams. It's, you know, in the old days, Bernie liked to kind of set the teams against one another so that he could play them all. He was a puppet master. And by putting them against one another, he could control his little show. We now exist in a time of relative peace and unity, because Liberty have kind of seen that by bringing everybody together and creating that sense of oneness, of mutual benefit, that we can actually, as a sport, prosper. There's the adage of, you know, the rising tide lifts all ships, was what Liberty went with, rather than divide and conquer. So that's the major difference now, I think, and you do see it. Turkeys don't vote for Christmas, so you're never going to get total unity. And if Mercedes or Ferrari are voting in favor of something, it's because it will benefit them. You know, they're not doing it to help the little guys. So there'll always be that. It's a business at the end of the day. And more than that, you know, it's a competition. And so if there is ever anything that can give a team a leg up, a helping hand that will set them on a competitive advantage to their rivals, they will take it. But certainly in terms of the harmony that exists, it's far better than it's ever been. And the openness as well. In the old days, Formula One was all about its exclusivity, the eliteness of the sport. And it is still that. But there is a willingness now and a desire to open the sport and to be more welcoming and inclusive. Bernie was always about the sport being just out of touch. You know, you could never quite get it. And that made it really aspirational. Liberty are about giving you a taste. And believing that if you have that little taste, you'll want more and come back for more. Bernie was about, don't even let them get it on their tongue, you know. Yeah. But this is, give them a taste and they'll want it. It is a bit more open. That I think is the greatest difference that I've seen in the 20 years.
I think that's probably the best way to describe it. And we talk about Liberty Media, and it would be amiss to not talk about Drive to Survive, which has been a massive eye-opener for not only just existing fans who wanted a bit more than just a taste, but also it has brought in a ton of new fans who may not have really been interested in Formula One because of its previous sort of stature. But now there's a whole new audience, a younger audience who are hungry for Formula One. And that's really promising, because you really want to promote to not only the current generation of Formula One fans, but you should always, there should always be this ideal of looking ahead at, okay, what's our next generation of fan going to be? What's going to make them excited about Formula One, and how can we make the experience more accessible?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been, I think, hugely successful in that regard. As you say, it's brought in fans who had never watched Formula One. I've been contacted by people who fell out of love with Formula One, who've been brought back into the fold by Drive to Survive. And, you know, if you're a diehard fan, yeah, you'll pick little bits up and say, well, that, you know, that's supposed to be from the British Grand Prix, but they're on the pit wall in Belgium or whatever. There's a small amount of artistic and poetic license that's taken in certain aspects of the show, but it's done to sort of create that the storytelling, to help the storytelling, and I think it's wonderful. It's really, really great. It's a joy. I play a small part in it, and I really love being a part of it. And the thing is that the crew really love being a part of Formula One, and you can see how much they enjoy being immersed in the sport and bringing people's stories out as well. They it's great. It's been a real sort of massive success, I think, and hopefully many more seasons to come, because the next few years are going to be incredible.
There is a massive excitement to what lies ahead in Formula One. So we get to 2020. Opening race of the season is meant to be in Australia.
Yeah,
COVID hits. What was your experience as a whole going to the circuit? Opening round was in Austria. How different was it, being that, you know, normally the paddock is it's really an epicenter of activity. There's heaps of people around, to being almost just crew members, media members, and that was it.
Yeah, it was weird. It was really weird. We walked into the paddock in Austria, and I think one of the strangest things was actually getting back on an aeroplane for the first time, because you get so used to it. And then it had been 4 months or something, longest time that I think for any of us hadn't been on an aeroplane. And for the drivers, the longest time that they hadn't been in a car since they were kids. And most of them still are kids. But, you know, walking into that paddock and seeing how empty it was, and it was just us, just the absolute essentials that were working there. And, you know, the media were stuck in the media center, and we and our TV crews were, you know, very much stuck in the paddock area, and we couldn't go to the places that we'd normally go to. We just thought, okay, this is just going to be what this is for the first race or first two races. And then as the year went on, it was like, no, this is just it now. And it became normal pretty quickly, you know, having a big plastic stick shoved up your nose you know, twice every 3 days was just normal. You know, getting tested, having that done, it was just what life's become, really, isn't it? And, you know, wearing a mask and having to read what people say through the ruffles of their forehead and their eyes, because you can't see their full face anymore. And trying to figure out people's, because as you're interviewing them, you're always trying to read them, to figure them out, and not being able to see their full face makes that really, really difficult. But yeah, it's been a learning process for sure. Who knows when we'll get back to anything that looks like the normal we used to know. But it's been a very different year.
I think
for in terms of accessibility of people, it's been very hard to do your job as a journalist. It's been very, very hard. You know, most of the press conferences are done via video call, and as you sort of see in the real world of politics or whatever, you know, people aren't held to account as much as they were, because on a video call you can't follow up the question, and there isn't the rigor of questioning that there used to be. And the same's true in sport. You know, we had the whole controversy last year over Racing Point, or Aston Martin as it's known now, and their use of the Mercedes car and parts of the Mercedes car from the year before, and was that legal and wasn't that legal? And I think that would have been dealt with in a very different manner were we not under COVID restrictions. I think the questions that were put to them, I think the way in which it all came out, they would have been held to task much harder if it wasn't under COVID times than it actually was. But they couldn't be because they never got to be questioned properly about it.
Yeah, and a luxury it was. And of course, if you've seen Drive to Survive Season 3, you'll know the undertakings of what happened. Opening episode is the winter testing, and then the lead through to how it became Aston Martin. I mean, I guess I'd be remiss to not ask about Lawrence Stroll, who I know you mentioned in the episode. He, and I even, my dad, who doesn't know a lot about Formula 1, but is starting to get into it thanks to the rebrand of Aston Martin coming in. Is he someone, when you just see him, he's got a commanding presence, a real aura?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And he's great. He's great to be around. And he knows business. He doesn't, he's not getting involved with this as some sort of jokey thing or some throwaway thing. You know, he's been a success in everything that he's ever done. He's not started a Formula One team just because he's bored. You know, he's done it to be the best. He's done it to take that team and make them world champions. He's set himself 5 years to do it. If anyone can do that, I'd say it's probably Lawrence. You know, he is ruthless. But as you say, he has that aura, an absolute commanding personality that when he's around, he just, everything gravitates sort of towards him. Quite an amazing person to sort of be around.
I could imagine. We should also talk about the game, the video game F1 2020, which you were a part of during interviews.
How mad's that?
Do you find that amazing that there are millions upon millions of people playing the F1 game, playing career mode in my team, and you're in the game questioning the player on, you know, a bunch of different activities?
I still have Nigel Mansell's World Championship Challenge on the Game Boy, right? Like, that was my first experience of playing an F1 game. I had Super Monaco Grand Prix on the Game Gear, you know, all that kind of stuff. And now here, there's an official Formula One computer game, and you get my stupid face asking you questions. What's that all about? It's mad. It's completely mad.
I love it.
Yeah. Go tell the 13-year-old Will that he's going to be in a computer game one day. You know, as part of a Formula One computer game. No way. It's mental. I'm so thrilled to be a part of it. It's great. It's absolutely great. I love it. My daughter thinks it's the funniest thing because she looks at it and she goes, oh, that, it looks just like you, Daddy. And then I start talking and she's like, oh, that doesn't look like you. It's really funny. But yeah, completely crazy. And I loved it. And the one thing I really loved is it got me the opportunity to go into Pinewood Studios in London to go and do the green screen, to do all the motion capture. You know, you wear the suit with the bubbles all over it, you know, like you're going to be in an Avengers movie or something. And it was so cool because you're in this. I saw the screen and they're playing back what I'd done, and I'm in this virtual paddock walking around, but I'm in a studio at Pinewood, you know, with the James Bond stage next door, and they were filming Black Widow two stages down. Scarlett Johansson's running around the place, and it's just like, this is insane. This isn't life. This is mad.
That's awesome. Let's move on then to the current season. Of course, at the time of recording this, we are only a few days away from the second Grand Prix of the season. It has it's felt like an age since Bahrain.
Has it?
I don't think we can do 3 weeks again. It's too long. Someone's going to tell Stefano Domenicali, no more. We don't do that anymore. Except for the winter break, of course, when the teams deserve the time off to speed family. But during the season, no chance. Bahrain was an amazing race because there was a lot of talk and a lot of assumption, really, that it's going to be the status quo, you know, Mercedes will figure it out. And in reality of the race and the whole weekend, Max Verstappen was the best driver in the best car. And he was beaten by someone who just made things happen in Lewis Hamilton. It was a truly amazing Grand Prix.
Yeah, it was. It was. And it's, you know, coming out of testing, I didn't believe that Mercedes were hiding anything. They genuinely struggled over the winter. And, you know, for them to come out of that first race with the win showed the work that they'd been able to put in since testing. But it also, as you say, highlighted the brilliance of Lewis Hamilton as a now seven-time world champion. And that can't be overlooked, because I think that was one of his most impressive drives in years, because he really had to fight. He really had to make that race his, because, as you say, he wasn't in the best car for the first time in a long time. And to still come out on top against a driver of Max's caliber was brilliant. That was the drive of a seven-time world champion. Take nothing away from Lewis, because that was superhuman. Where we go from here, though, is the longest season in Formula One history, 23 races if they're all done. And Max Verstappen in a Red Bull that looks to be the most competitive out there. So it's going to be a great season. I'm very excited. But the other thing that was great about that race was how good the rest of the landscape looks. McLaren, Ferrari, AlphaTauri, Aston Martin, Alpine, you know, all of these teams who look incredibly closely matched. Alfa Romeo in there as well. It's going to be a great season. It's going to be really, really enjoyable, I think. There's going to be a lot of close racing. It's going to be a good year. I've got really high hopes for it.
And the great thing about this year is there's so many storylines to talk with. You look at Alonso returning with Alpine. You have, you know, where's Pierre Gasly's ceiling? Because at the end of this season there, I think there's going to be a few teams that will be thinking, geez, he could be good in our colours. You've got Aston Martin coming in, Seb Vettel trying to rejuvenate his career after a really difficult 2020. And then you've got the likes of, can Daniel Ricciardo get McLaren on the podium, maybe as a race winner? And then you've got the rookies, Yuki Tsunoda, who is just super exciting.
Oh, he's the man. Yeah,
he is amazing. And you saw glimpses in F2 that he was the real deal. And that move on Alonso and then Stroll on the last lap, he almost reminds me of, and this will maybe be doing him a little bit of discredit, when Kamui Kobayashi would be that.
That's a great example. Because Kamui was exactly the same. A lot of drivers will come up behind somebody and they'll wait. They'll try and watch them and see their lines and then figure out how they're going to pass them. Kobayashi was exactly like Tsunoda, straight in there. Get up to them, get past them. Don't even weigh it up. Just send it. And that's a really good comparison, actually. Really, really good. But yeah, hugely exciting, man, for all of those reasons and more. It's I think the story, and we're going into next year, a brand new set of technical regulations to bring the field closer together. The team's already thinking about, you know, who they want in their cars. Will we have a totally new lineup at Mercedes for next year? Is this Lewis Hamilton's last year? There's all of this to be played out. And potentially a new world champion at the end of the year. There's so much to play for.
It is super exciting. And I did also forget to mention Mick Schumacher in Formula One. A Schumacher back on the grid. His initials as well, MSC, sorry, which was great touch.
Which was Michael's. Yeah, lovely touch. Really, really lovely. Because, it's great to see him back. He's not going to have an easy year. No. He's at a team and in a car which is, you know, firmly at the back and will not be developed throughout the season. But it's a good preparatory year for him to just, you know, let him get his feet wet and then really enjoy what 2022 can bring.
I think we also saw, if we take his two seasons at Prema in F2, his first season was marred with inconsistency. Of course, he had the win at the Hungaroring in the sprint race, but you could see the signs that the first season, it's almost like he's got, there's nothing to worry about. First season, just try and learn the craft, learn everything, do the best you can. And if somehow there's a bonkers race where a ton of cars retire, maybe pick up a point. All he has to do is beat Mazepin, and you get the feeling that, you know, Ferrari, who probably can't even hide the fact that eventually they'll want him in their car. It's going to be so fascinating to see how that plays out, because you really want him to do well.
I think, you know, Mick has always taken a while to get his feet under the table. You mentioned there in Formula 2, you know, it took a good year and a bit for him to really find his confidence, find a place. Same in Formula 3, same in Formula 4. First season was one of learning, understanding the craft. Year 2 was when he went on a title tilt. And, you know, the same in Formula 1 is very hard to do because the car is so quickly developed and so constantly evolving in Formula 1. You don't have that opportunity to bed yourself in. So actually having this year with a car that won't be changed at all during the season will allow him what he normally has had in F4, F3, F2, which is a year of understanding, a year of learning. But then he's got to step it up. 2022, he has got to step it up. And he has got to be competitive. The Ferrari seat is not a certainty. You look at how Carlos Sainz is fitting in there alongside Charles Leclerc. Charles Leclerc with the longest contract in Ferrari history. Not even Michael Schumacher had a contract as long as Charles Leclerc has. And if Carlos can prove himself to be exactly what they need alongside him, there was not going to be a seat there. And just because Mick is a Schumacher does not mean a thing. Yes, it's beautiful and it's very romantic. But it's the stopwatch that tells the truth. It's not a name. Your name doesn't count for anything. It's what you do with that stopwatch. And he's got to be quick because, you know, there are other drivers in the Ferrari Academy, the likes of Callum Ilott or Robert Schwartzman or, you know, real quality drivers that may find their way into the sport and may jump him if he doesn't get the job done and if he doesn't step it up in 2022. So, I really wish him the best, and I really can't wait to see how he evolves and how he develops and how he settles into Formula One. But, you know, romance only sort of goes so far until you have to look at the stopwatch and figure out if the merit exists. And I hope it does, because I think Mick could be something really, really good if it all plays out.
Absolutely, and it's definitely a watch this space, especially... You know, he's got the contract for 2 seasons, and as we mentioned before, the grid could be even more jumbled up in terms of who's where, because there's so many drivers who don't have a contract beyond this season. I guess I've got one more question after this, but is there a driver that's currently at a team that you'd like to see elsewhere, just to see what would happen?
Oh, well, for years, you know, everyone said Perez, everyone wanted to see Perez, and now he's at Red Bull this year, and that is the opportunity of a lifetime. So I'm super, super excited about that. I think we all want to see what George Russell can do in a serious car. You know, we got a glimpse of that in Bahrain last year at the Sakhir Grand Prix when he should have won in Lewis Hamilton's car. So yeah, that would be fantastic. I'd like to see Gasly get a shot in a race. Well, he's in a race winning car because he managed to win a race last year for AlphaTauri, but you know, in a car that has a decent tilt at the title would be great. Honestly, I think a Russell Gasly lineup at Mercedes would be incredible, but I don't think Mercedes will take Gasly. I think Gasly might end up at Alpine, you know, because of his French background, but who knows, you know, maybe Ocon and Russell will end up at Mercedes. I don't know. I'm excited for Ricciardo at McLaren with that Mercedes engine in the back. I think that's going to be great. The interesting thing for me is nobody's talking about Lando. Where does Lando end up? You know, is he just locked into McLaren forever? There doesn't seem to be that buzz around Lando, which I find odd because he is a great driver and he's really exciting. Maybe everyone just knows that McLaren have got this hold on him, and so he won't be on the market anytime soon. But then everyone thought that about Lewis, and look how that worked out.
Yeah, this is true. I guess this is a bit of a spin on a question that we, from the Formula One game, and I wanted to end on this because I felt this would be a very interesting discussion to have. Of course, if you've got F1 2020, you can play as your own team, enter your own team into the grid, and you're the 11th team in Formula One. So I pose to you, based on the available drivers on the market, you can pluck them from virtually anywhere, but not currently in a team in F1, what would your driver lineup look like if you were, hypothetically speaking, entering the Formula One grid?
It's tough, man. It's so hard. Look, I would look at the depth of talent that exists in Formula E and in IndyCar and pluck some drivers out of those championships. I think Antonio Felix da Costa was cruelly overlooked by Red Bull, and could and should have had an opportunity. I'd love to see him in Formula One. I've always been a bit of a fan of Sam Bird. I'd like to see how he could do. Looking at IndyCar, Joseph Newgarden, Alexander Rossi, be fascinating to see how they could do. One guy I want to see right now, who, and I'm not just saying this because obviously you are, over in Australia, and is the guy who's currently killing supercars, and I believe is unbeaten since October, Shane van Gisbergen, who, holy hell, that guy's unbeatable. Like he's a superstar this year. I mean, he's always been a superstar, but this year in particular, and he went back and did single seaters and did the New Zealand Grand Prix at the start of the year and just won everything. I mean, he's not human right now.
He's invincible. And the funny thing, he won the Bathurst Triple Crown. I think he's maybe the first or second driver to ever do that.
Second driver in history. Yeah. And it's completely insane. Completely insane. And with cracked ribs. And a broken back or whatever it is. I mean, for God's sake. But yeah, love to see him. There are so many brilliant racers out there, and there's only 20 seats in Formula One. It does highlight the need for more teams, but good teams with backing, with budget. But yeah, I'd love to see that. Would love to see that.
I think we'll learn from what happened in 2010, where we had three backmarkers who just stayed backmarkers for the majority. And that wasn't good. I'll give you my two because I've thought about this for about 5 minutes. The Stoffel Vandoorne is probably one.
Stoffel's a great shout, yeah.
I feel really bad for him because he had Alonso as his teammate, and Alonso just destroyed every part of him. And you just wondered what was going to happen. I think he's doing a very good job at in Formula E with Mercedes. And I think the other one, it's because there's so many to pick from, I would actually pick his teammate Nyck de Vries. He dominated the 2019, no, 2018 Formula 2 season, beating the likes of Nicholas Latifi, Luca Giotto, and it never
Yeah,
really felt like, yeah, it never really
DeVries
felt,
quality.
yeah, it never really felt like he got a fair shake of the sauce bottle, as they say. I mean, he did do the young driver's test at the end of the season, which, as it was, but, and he was, I think he could do, I think they would both be good shouts. Van Doorn is someone who has F1 experience, and De Vries, the Dutch fans will get around him like they do Max Verstappen, massive following. The Dutch people love the sport, and you just love. I would love to see it because I feel like he was wrongly kind of missed out
Agreed.
for dominating a category which we know is super competitive. Like he dominated that season and didn't get an opportunity, but. Alas, I think he might get one eventually. It just maybe it take him winning Formula E or something, and or even
It's
the Mercedes
astonishing,
seat,
isn't it?
or even the
Yeah, I
Mercedes seat.
mean, if Lewis does go at the end of the year, and if they decide they don't want to continue with Valtteri, you look at the opportunities, the potential drivers that they have on their books, George Russell, as you say, Van Dorn and De Vries from their Formula E squad, they have such strength in depth that they can pull on. It's going to be fascinating to see who's racing for Mercedes in 2022. And I wouldn't put it past one of those Formula E boys coming back to Formula One, because heaven knows they deserve it. You say Stoffel, supreme talent, absolutely supreme, and got bitten by F1, but I think could and would still do the job if you put him back in there in a heartbeat.
Absolutely. Will, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Right, my pleasure, my pleasure.
Best of luck for the season ahead. And as you go through the years, we'll be very much watching intently.
Thanks, mate. I really appreciate it. And thanks for having me on. It's been great fun.
What a thrill to have one of the biggest names in Formula One media on the podcast. His love of the sport and what he does is very much telling. It's such an excitement to have him talk about his passion and what he does. A big thank you to Ben Gorman from Buckfold Media
for helping set up this episode, and of course to Will himself for giving up his precious time to come chat with me. You can find Will at Twitter on @WBoxtonOfficial and subscribe to his YouTube channel where he provides news from all the major racing series from around the world. I'll be back soon with the next episode of One on One. Thank you so much for listening to the second episode of the series, and I'll see you next time.